I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, we are taking a break from our regularly scheduled observation that everything is awful to have a little fun and answer your questions. We've been recording Impolite Company for more than half a year now, and realized we never really told you who we are and why we started the pod.
And to be honest, this is also a good excuse for us to learn more about each other, so we're not blindsided by revelations like the fact that Amy has seen virtually none of the classic 80s movies, like The Goonies.
Or that Nish is really a Duke basketball fan.
Of course I am. Ugh. So, buckle up, pod fans, something different this week.
Before we begin, our thanks to the show's monthly patrons who support our work through their sponsorship. We're halfway to our goal now, which allows us to cover the basic costs of editing and releasing these episodes. But in order to do things like improve the technical quality of these shows, we need your help. To give just one recent example, this is actually our, third time recording this episode?
I think so.
After previous attempts have produced completely garbled audio, which wouldn't be useful to anybody, really. So if you like what we're doing at Impolite Company and you want our complete conversations instead of the audio that our dear producer is able to stitch together, we're asking you to consider becoming a monthly sponsor. It couldn't be simpler. Just click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast.
Okay, Amy, let's go ahead and jump right in. I am going to go through the list and toss out a question, which we will both do our best to answer. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay, here we go. First question. Number one, how did you and Amy meet and how do you guys work together? We met on the always encouraging and uplifting website, twitter.com. Where one can go for all of their answers and life's problems.
and podcast co-hosts.
Yeah, and podcast co-hosts. So I put out to my followers, hey, if I started a religion and politics podcast, would anybody listen? And then Amy slid into my DMs very enthusiastically. It was like, do you need a co-host?
I think it took me all of 5 seconds to type in all caps, do you need a co-host?
That's right. And so that's kind of how we met was, or at least like started a friendship relationship. We had followed each other and each other's work for a while and had tweeted at each other back and forth.
And I remember having to like hold myself back from liking all of your tweets because I thought that would seem a little crazy and stalkerish, but seemed like we had the same sensibility.
Yeah, it seemed that way. And so that's how we met. And we worked together by Amy is in her place in Illinois and I'm in my place in Idaho. And we are currently talking to each other on the phone since we are so far away from each other. And we're both recording our own audio tracks onto our computers. And then we send those files off to our wonderful and always patient producer who deals with all of our amateur hour.
Our long-suffering producer.
I know. He totally exhibits the biblical quality of long-suffering, for sure. So we send him our individual tracks, and then he splices those together so it sounds like we're actually in studio together. So little magic behind the curtain for you.
Which, sadly, we have never been.
I know.
We have met once, but we have never actually recorded together in person.
One of these days, it'll be great. So we can actually see each other's facial reactions when we talk. So I'm kind of like going off of what I know Amy's face looks like. And I'm like, okay, what is her response going to be right now? And I can kind of see it in my brain.
Is she rolling her eyes or not?
Yeah. And Amy probably already knows by now, having met me, that anytime I'm talking, my hands are going 100 miles an hour. I talk with my hands also. So anyway, that is how we work together. Okay. Next question. What's one book that has changed you? Amy, you want to go first?
Yes. And I am cheating because I was trying to think of books that have influenced me. And there are so many. And I came up with a list of books, particularly books that I read early on. But I couldn't say that they changed me so much as they shaped me. And I think that's significant as well as being changed by a book. So I'm going to briefly run through a list of 5 books that shaped me early on, and then 1 book that changed me. So I'm starting with Girls Could Be Anything. It was a picture book that I can never remember not having in my life, but it was published in 1974, which was when I was 1. And the point of the book is basically girls can do anything boys can do, except as our hero Marina learns, a woman has never been president of the United States. I remember being just appalled and thinking that that was the biggest injustice when I was a small girl. And it continues to be something that appalls me, because when I picked up this book, I've been looking for library copies on eBay for years. When I got a copy to read to our daughter in 2012, still no woman present, and still in 2018. So that's awesome. But that got me started down the road towards militant feminism as a 7-year-old. Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, another book that I loved, 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 and that was influential in shaping my sense that the end of slavery had not been a silver bullet that just led to equality everywhere. On the beach, I had a weirdo 6th grade teacher who gave my reading group all science fiction books, and among them, we read Fahrenheit, 451? And tons of Isaac Asimov. And we read On the Beach, which, since I was a Cold War kid who was convinced we were all going to die in a nuclear apocalypse before I was an adult anyway, just kind of cemented for me. That way I could just picture what the nuclear apocalypse was going to look like. RFK and His Times was really influential for me. Bobby Kennedy was huge in our house growing up. Not quite a deity, but not a deity. And reading this really complex and nuanced story of his life gave me an appreciation for politicians just as I was entering work in politics, to understand that you can really support the policies that somebody has been behind while understanding that they themselves are complicated people. And in Bobby's case, also understanding that a person can change pretty dramatically in terms of their politics from serving as counsel, I believe, on the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 50s to being JFK's attorney general and then one of my favorite senators. So that was a book that really stuck with me. And the last one was Backlash by Susan Faludi, which I read in college, which basically helped me realize that social progress is always going to prompt a backlash of some sorts. We are living through one right now, listeners. And this was about the backlash to the women's movement in the 70s and 80s, and just enormously influential for me. And the book that changed me is not my favorite book by any stretch, not to diss it, but it is like a lot of the books that he has written over the years. But Jim Wallace's Soul of Politics, I read in the 90s, and it was the first like official treatment of modern Christian social justice, where I recognized in somebody else the mix of my politics and my faith that I hadn't really seen outside my family. You know, I had just come to DC to work on the Hill, and the people in the Baptist church I grew up in were not psyched that I was going to be working with Democrats.
I can't imagine.
And the Democratic colleagues I had were kind of wrong-footed by the fact that I was this Baptist girl who went to church every week. And to just read Jim's story and read about the stories of so many other people who were like me was kind of the first version of what I get from my religion Twitter, which is finding other people like you, Nish, and like me, and getting started on this whole look into religion and politics.
That's awesome.
So what about you?
Okay. I've got a quick list. My first one was the kids novel, I guess you could call it. I mean, I am rereading it now to my daughter and it's still just as good. It holds up. Let's say that it holds up, which is Matilda by Roald Dahl. I read it as a young girl and I just remember feeling a real sense of kinship with the character who just loved to read. She loved getting, you know, immersed in the stories of books and of novels. And I loved it. I loved everything about the book. It felt magical to me. I'm lucky that I had two wonderful parents, not like the Wormwoods in Matilda.
I should hope they were not.
Right. My parents were amazing and wonderful. And actually, I had teachers that were also lovely. So Matilda was the first one. The second one was To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. My daughter's name Scout. If you have listened to the pod at all, you know, you could probably guess that's where she got her name. And it is. She was named after that, the character in the book. I promised myself when I read it in high school that if I ever had a little girl, I would name her Scout, because the character was, I loved Scout actually more than I loved Atticus Finch, because Scout was this wild girl who was really curious and pushed buttons and asked questions. And that's kind of who I've always been. And so I loved her. I loved her. I obviously loved the themes of justice. And that was the first time I really got a dose of, you know, what racial injustice and what racial justice does look like and how racism plays out. And that was, you know, I was a high schooler in the South and we had to read that book. So it was hugely impactful for me. I obviously, there are a lot of problems with it and problems with Atticus Finch that you could dissect for days and days, and lots of scholars have done so. But for a kid in high school who is, you know, who wants to ask those questions and who needs to be exposed to some of those ideas, I'm still a pretty big defender of that book. So anyway, How to Kill a Mockingbird is the other one. And then the one that was the most monumental.
And you did turn out to have a scout.
I did turn out to have
an actual scout.
Like, she is actually the character. And someone said, when you name your children, be careful because they're going to live up to their name.
Yeah, well, just like our friend Danielle has a Ramona, who is definitely right, Ramona. Yeah.
She's such a Ramona.
You guys were cursing your children there.
Yeah, exactly. Or blessing them, depending on
blessing them, yes.
But she's totally the character, which is amazing. She's this wild, wonderful, amazing creature that I just cannot get enough of. Anyway, and so my third book that really changed me and shaped me as a person, particularly in my faith journey, was The Ragamuffin Gospel by Brennan Manning. That book is still, like, I still go back and read it. It is still such a message of hope and grace and welcome for people of faith.
I don't know that book.
Oh.
Can you give us a, like, two-sentence synopsis?
It's so good. It's so good. So Brennan Manning, one of the giants of faith, he wrote this book called Ragamuffin Gospel. He's written tons of other books, but this is the one that I know him for the most. And it is this wonderful book where he talks about what it means to be a ragamuffin. So this person who is, I don't want to say broken, but who is in desperate need of grace, and how the life of Jesus and the gospel is for all of us who are ragamuffins, who see ourselves as people who don't fit, who see ourselves as people who never can measure up, who can never seem to make it work on our own, and who are just in desperate need of this radical, wonderful, hospitable grace. And it's offered to everybody, and it shapes us, and it allows us to offer that grace to other people. And it's kind of the quintessential book on that topic. And it's what opened my eyes to being what it means to actually be a welcoming and hospitable person to anyone, and what it means to actually offer grace to someone and how that can change their life. And so that was probably the most formative book of my faith journey that I can remember. There have been a lot of other ones, but that was one that, like, I still revisit, like Matilda. It holds up. The message holds up, and it's so good. So if you haven't read it, it's one of those kind of cornerstone books for me. So I would definitely highly recommend. 10 out of 10 would read. Okay. Next question.
All right.
Can we get an episode co-hosted by Scout and Amy's son, parentheses, I forgot his name.
His name is Cormac. Not Cormie. I'm Cormac, is what he says.
The question is, do you really want that? That's what I want to know. I mean, sure. I'll bring Scout on the pod. She has wonderfully big opinions about things. I'm sure she'd be a riot to listen to. I don't know that I would ever get a word in.
And Cormac just has opinions.
Yeah.
Big, small, he's just got opinions on everything.
And I can't promise that Scout would talk about religion and politics. You'll probably get an entire Star Wars episode with a side of Amy Grant with Cormac. So. Which would actually be a wonderful mashup.
That would be pretty fun.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm happy to bring her on the pod. She'd probably get a kick out of it. Okay, next question. Washington Post or the New York Times, Amy? Not that you're biased.
Seriously, people. Seriously.
New York Times help pays Amy's mortgage, people.
Yeah. So my husband is Noam Scheiber, a journalist at the New York Times on the religion work jobs beat, which he has made into such a fantastic.
It's so good.
Fantastic beat. That he uses to tell stories of all sorts. Maybe one of my favorite pieces of his ran about a month ago about Doris Burke, who's the first woman to get to do color commentary on ESPN. Yeah. For national broadcast of NBA games. And they need to bring Doris back because these dudes who have been doing the conference finals, not doing it.
Are terrible.
Give us Doris.
Bring back Doris. She's so good. I love watching pro basketball when she is commentating, which is not often anymore because we don't, like we've talked about multiple times, we don't have internet, but she's.
Yeah. So we were watching game 7, Cleveland and Boston on, I guess that would be Sunday night. And we were in a bar in Chicago because we actually got a staycation where my parents came out and watched the kids.
Nice.
And we could just go out. It was wonderful. And we've spent actually most of the 14 years we've been together watching NBA playoff games together.
Two so basketball
it was,
fans.
It was pretty awesome. But we watched the game. We watched LeBron James literally carry a Celtic on his back who had both hands on his shoulders trying to keep him down. Just amazing. But then what we really wanted was to see the after game, post game interview, because Noam was like, this is going to be an epic Doris and LeBron conversation. And the bar immediately put it on mute after the game was over. And we couldn't hear a word that they said.
What?
So we got to go find it online somewhere because we love Doris. Anyway, that was a tangent from the original question, which was to say, so I have to be a supporter of the New York Times. Also, particularly on the Me Too beat, which you could argue they helped kick off last fall. Their reporting has just been amazing. Like their investigative reporting is just invaluable. But I am also a huge fan of the Washington Post. I think the Post as it is today is maybe the most exciting place in newspaper journalism. I've been telling younger journalists in DC for a while that if they want to go to someplace that's doing really innovative stuff and hiring a whole mix of people and giving them a lot of freedom, that the Post is the place to be. And they have been just as scrappy and really coming up with some fabulous reporting. So support both of those, support your local news. They need the help and you need them to tell you what's actually going on. Because people in power want to hide things and it's journalists' job to find out.
Yeah, it's a great time for journalism, but it's also a really scary time for journalism. So when people ask me, Washington Post or New York Times, I simply say, yes, subscribe to both, please. Even if it's just the digital edition, if you have the extra money to spare, it goes a long way.
Especially if it's the digital edition.
Yeah.
We've been trying to get editions without actually getting the physical paper. And more outlets need to offer that.
Yep. And it's also a scary time for journalism. There are papers that are slashing staff. Our previous hometown paper, the Salt Lake Tribune, just cut a third of its staff. And it only had like 90 people on staff and it cut 30 people. The Denver Post had massive cuts. It's just, it's a hard time to be in journalism. But as much as it's an exciting time, there's no shortage of things to cover. But it's also a scary time. So support your local papers, support the Washington Post and the New York Times. They both do really great reporting. So my answer to that is always just yes. Okay, next question. How do you talk to your kids about Trump? I will keep my answer brief. We don't really, unless they ask. We don't offer information unless they ask about it. We did take the kids to a local protest back in Utah when they were going to repeal the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, because it's those sorts of repeals and public lands issues affect our industry, which is whitewater rafting. That's how we make our money. And so we're very invested in that. The outdoor community is very invested in protecting public lands. So it was not really... We couched it, we tried to couch it not so much as a Trump thing, but just we want to save the land so that everybody can go play and everyone can go see it. And so that was kind of their first foray into being politically active. And so we got to answer questions and talk to them about it, which was really good. But regarding Trump, we just don't talk to him about it. And if they have questions about things that they hear at school or whatever, then we're honest and we don't hide our opinion. But... yeah, that's kind of how we approach it. I don't know about you guys, Amy, especially as journalists, how you guys kind of tackle it.
It's actually really similar. We do not talk about it. It hasn't really been an issue as journalists because we talk to each other all the time about our work, but it doesn't need to come up in front of the kids. I have noticed that I don't listen to NPR in front of them because I don't want them to hear. But it's not just Trump. It's, you know, I don't necessarily want them hearing about a school shooting. I don't want them hearing about what's going on in Syria. It's not that I don't want them to know about this stuff. I mean, you know, we've had a lot of conversations in the past year about the floods in Houston and the hurricanes hitting Puerto Rico. And we have talked because they couldn't help but hear after Trump took office when there were the protests at airports against the travel ban and the Muslim ban. So they know some stuff, and as you say, they do hear from other kids, and we live in a particularly liberal area. The one thing that I have found helpful to talk to our daughter about, and it's just as a way of being able to relate to her, is I grew up with Ronald Reagan as the first president I really was aware of and thought of him as my nemesis because I came from a very liberal democratic home. And she was telling me, I guess a couple of weeks ago, she has a friend who has a magic eight ball because yes, everything old is new again. And they were asking the magic eight ball, will Donald Trump die? Which, you know, we're all going to die, but they were hopefully asking, please, will he die? And instead of chewing her out over that, I talked to her about the fact that I can clearly remember the day in 1981 when I was in second grade and the teacher next door came in and was just kind of in shock and said, the president's been shot. And my little seven-year-old brain, the first reaction was, good. And I am not proud of that, but it is kind of how you process things when you think in very stark good and evil terms. And so it allowed me to have a really productive conversation with her about how we can disagree with people, but we do not wish our opponents harm. Because one of the reasons that she doesn't like Trump is she knows and believes that he is he's hurting people, that a lot of his policies are leading to anguish and hurting people. And if we wish him harm, then we are no better. So that was something we talked about, and that will probably be the extent of it until she brings it up again. I don't want to hide my kids from anything, but particularly this guy. I am so thankful that they are too young, at least for now, to be infected by what's happened to civil discourse.
Oh, it's so heavy to talk to kids about this stuff, which is why we just don't until they ask. Because there will be a time when they'll have to grow up and be aware to all this, and that's a hard day. And I just want my kids to be kids. You know, I just want them to not have to worry about this stuff as long as I can, which I know comes from a place of profound privilege. But if I would like to, just like any parent, you want to protect that innocence as long as you can. So that's, yeah, good answer. Okay. Who are your favorite journalists to read? Oh man, have I got a list. My first one, obviously, I know. First one, obviously, is Husband of the Pod, Noam Schreiber. Second one, if you want to read really great profiles of individuals, always go to Taffy Broadister Ackner. She writes for New York Times Arts and New York Times Magazine and has also written for GQ. Her stuff is, she's one of those writers that you read her stuff and it makes you both want to be a better writer, but it also makes you want to quit because you're never going to be that good. She is that great. For disability stuff, for those of you who have asked about disability things, I read David Perry, who writes for Pacific Standard. Two people that I've been following a lot lately with their investigative journalism is Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer for The New Yorker. And I think someone said on Twitter about Jane Mayer was, if Jane Mayer comes calling, she's one of those reporters that, like, you better make sure you have your affairs in order because she is going to uncover all of the skeletons. If you want to know more about what's happening in the Middle East with ISIS, particularly in Iraq, I follow Rukmini Kalamachi at The New York Times. I follow Jody Kantor and Megan Toohey for The New York Times, who won the Pulitzer for their coverage of Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too movement. For, well, really all of Trump's like foundation taxes type stuff, I follow David Fahrenthold at The Washington Post. For religion stuff, there's no one better, I think, than Jack Jenkins, Ruth Graham, and Elizabeth Dias. They are kind of top-notch folks. Obviously, present company goes without saying. If you like watching 24-hour news, if that's your thing, the only one that I can tolerate, frankly, is Jake Tapper on CNN. Mostly because I find him really endearing. He's done a few interviews with Stephen Colbert, and I find him pretty funny. So I like Jake Tapper. I like Jamil Smith from Rolling Stone. I like Jamel Bowie from Slate. And obviously, Ta-Nehisi Coates for The Atlantic. He's also one of those writers that makes you want to quit every time you read what he writes. So that's my list. It's a lot, but I follow a lot of folks. What about you?
Yeah. As you said, it's a good time for journalism.
Yeah.
It's a tough time as a reader. Just trying to keep up with all of the good journalism out there.
You can't.
So I have journalists I like to read in terms of, them as stylists. Like you say, Taffy just does amazing things with whatever subject she has, whether it's profiles or she wrote a piece about cooking in Israel last year for Savoir magazine, the fancy gourmet magazine. It was amazing. So writers like that, who I always turn to, David Gran, people whose bylines I'm always going to pick up what they read or what they write and know I'll enjoy it. Also at The New Yorker, Jill Lepore has written really some just fascinating stuff, especially she has a piece on the history and impact of the Second Amendment that everybody should pick up and go through. There's a guy at the Washington Post, his name is Terrence McCoy, who has been working for a few years now on different series for the paper, specifically focused on class. And he just writes with such empathy and detail. And every time I was reading these pieces and think, like, this is really fantastic stuff. And then, yes, it would turn out his name was attached to it again. And then the people who, when something happens, I want to know what they have to say about it. Jim Fallows at The Atlantic is kind of my, like, elder statesman who I always turn to. Christine Emba is a writer at The Washington Post. I think she might be part of the editorial board. She's doing some columns now. Anyway, she's written just a series of them in the last few months that have been really, really smart. Megan Garber at The Atlantic is another writer whose take I loved to read on things. Roxane Gay, also, same thing.
Oh, yeah.
And Jim Poniewozik, who I worked with at Time, he's now the New York Times main TV writer, TV critic. But he's so smart and has such a thoughtful mind. He has written what I think is one of the very best pieces to be able to understand Trump, about how Trump interacts with TV and with Fox News. And I'll put it in the show notes because I think about that piece probably more than any other that I've read in the past few years.
Every time he tweets, I actually think about it.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, what's he watching? You know what I mean? Like, it makes me think of it every time.
Yeah, but it's so smart in its understanding of Trump's mindset, and that it's really not very complicated, but nobody else had kind of laid it all out the way that Jim did in this piece. And I think it's brilliant. So there are a lot of good people out there, and you have no excuse if you're not reading at least a handful of them.
Okay, next question. Gosh, we have a lot more questions to go. Okay, here we go. This is cliche.
Maybe we should start doing a rapid fire round.
I know, seriously. This is cliche, but if you could have dinner with one living celebrity, who would it be? Oh, that's easy for me. Mine is Stephen Colbert.
Yeah. You stole mine.
Easily. He's just so great. You know, he's funny. He's brilliant. He's endearing. He's warm. He's a man of faith. I could ask him 1,000 different questions. I love him. I have loved him since he was a correspondent on The Daily Show. I just find him so great. So that would be... That's my pick. What about you?
I have my pick, which would be Michelle Obama.
Oh.
But realistically, I would probably just clam up because I think she's so awesome. And it has virtually nothing to do with politics or ideology for me with her. I just admire her and adore her in so many ways. So the celebrity who I think I could actually like hang out with and have a good conversation with over dinner is Kristen Bell, my fellow Michigander.
Oh, she's so funny.
She's just wonderful.
Gosh, she's funny.
She and Dax play board games at home. I feel like we would be able to hang out. We would have lots of Michigan stuff to talk about. They come to Michigan every summer with their kids to just hang out on the lake for a week. Yeah, they could go anywhere. They could just be in Malibu. They could go to the Caribbean. Nope. They come to Lake Michigan.
Nope.
Or Lake Huron.
So great.
Love that.
That's awesome. Dax has a new podcast called Armchair Expert. And it is so good. I've loved it.
I was just reporting to Noam on my listening. We try to divvy up the podcast so that we can then report back to each other.
Oh, that's smart. That's super smart. I should do that. Okay. Next question. Oh, this question's for Nish. Okay. Small town life or city life? I think there's benefits to both. And I have had the great fortune of living in a really great small town and a really great city. So my perspective may be a little different had I not liked one of those places that I've lived. But having loved both of them, there are benefits and downsides to both. I mean, we lived in Salt Lake City, which in the grand scheme of cities is small, manageable. We called it Small Lake City because you just ran into the same people everywhere. And I mean, we would complain if you had to sit, you know, in your car for more than 15 minutes getting across town. Like, it's not, it's really, really manageable. But to give you a little bit of perspective on how things have shifted since we lived in a small town, if we drive more than 5 minutes, we're like, oh, it's so far. So we've gotten really spoiled when it comes to just like population density issues. So anyway, yeah, I don't know. There's benefits and wonderful things about both. So I think for our family and our lifestyle, we would probably pick the small town. But I know a lot of people who would choose a city. So I think there's benefits to both. Okay. Next question. Oh gosh, really?
I am ready for this one.
Are you? Okay, yes. I'm gonna let you answer first. What is your best piece of parenting advice?
Can't pick just one.
I try to stay out of these.
So, number one.
Okay, go.
If you enjoy food and you want to be able to eat places once you are a parent that don't have kids menus, go at 5 or 5:30. Every restaurant is open. They need to fill those seats. And why not you and your kids? This is the way to actually get into like the best restaurants in your city or your small town and bring your kids along. So go early.
Yeah.
The kids get to eat. Everybody gets to bed on time. Everybody's happy.
So smart.
Number two, do dance parties to clean up the house or a particular room. Get yourself to the Container Store. Buy one of their little rotating disco balls for $15. Turn that on. Let the kids each pick a couple dance songs. And everybody just rocks out while they're cleaning up the living room or the playroom or the kitchen or whatever it is. Number three, this is kind of the big one, is learn how to manage expectations / spin as much as possible. By which I mean, don't throw your child a first birthday party with 75 people, because guess what? You're going to be locked in to birthday parties that are huge for the rest of that child's life, or at least childhood.
Yes.
We started out the kids with Christmas, and we still do this, where they get 3 presents.
Smart.
And you can build up from there. You can't go back down.
Yeah, once you let that monster out of the box.
And same thing, I'm always correcting Noam on this. If your kid asks for something, or if you're giving them something you don't want to give them more, you say like, here's a big scoop of ice cream. Not like, well, you can only have a little bit, because immediately they don't even know how big it is. They're going to start complaining if you sell it as like, this is just a little bit. You can't have very much.
Yep. That's smart.
So always be spinning.
Okay. Piece of parenting advice. I have a kid who doesn't fit in any parenting box. Every parenting book that I read does not work on this kid. He just doesn't fit the mold in any which way. And so the best piece of advice that I have learned, and again, my kids are only 8 and 5, so I am way early. I feel like a rookie. I should not be giving any advice. But if I had to give one piece of advice, it's just learn how to be flexible, hold everything loosely, and be comfortable with flying by the seat of your pants. Because things change, situations change, your kids change, you change. There's just a lot of dynamics that go into parenting, and having an idea of the values that matter to you, but how you want to implement those values, I think, requires a lot of trial and error. And so be okay with trying something and it not working. And so then moving on to the next thing, whether that's teaching your kid how to sleep by themselves when they're babies, to, you know, discipline and using kind words to one another when they're older. Like, there's just a whole host of things that I think that applies to. It's just trial and error. Parenting is nothing but trial and error, or it has been for us. So just be comfortable with that and be comfortable with failure. The more you can be comfortable with that, I think the better off everybody is. So that's the only piece of parenting advice I can give that I feel like is worth a damn. So, okay, next question. Oh, red or white wine? Red in the winter, white in the summer. Also rosé.
Yes, rosé.
Rosé, Jose.
Yeah. So red wine gives me headaches and makes me throw up.
Oh, yeah, don't drink that. Mm-mm.
Can't do red wine. Don't ever serve me red wine. I can cook with it. But,
Can't drink it.
Maybe a little bit of white wine. We have a friend in DC who every time she has a gathering just puts out like a variety of rosés. And it was so lovely. I always look forward to going to their house. And that really got me hooked on that. Well, they own a wine bar and a wine store. So I figured they know what they're doing.
Oh, well, that's nice. Nice friends you have there, Amy. Care to make an introduction? That'd be great.
Parents of Finney's first boyfriend.
Okay, next question.
Well, they were three.
Well, there you go. They were three. Boyfriend being a very loose term. Okay. If you had to pick today, who will be president on January 20th, 2021?
Never make predictions.
Do you want to answer first? Do you want me to answer first?
I say this as somebody whose very first vote was cast for Paul Tsongas in the 1992 Democratic primary. Paul Tsongas, who you all may remember, did not become president of the United States.
What?
I'm going to say, really? I'm not predicting an actual person, but I'm going to make what for me is the sad prediction that I believe we will still not have a woman president on January 20th, 2021. Because if we have learned so many things over the past few years, but I hope that we have definitely learned that we have some work to do in this country before we are ready for people to accept a woman in the highest leadership position. I just don't think we're there yet. And it really grieves me to say that, but we are not there. It was not like if Elizabeth Warren had run instead, she would have been fine. Nope. Elizabeth Warren, she may not have gotten the exact same attacks because Hillary was kind of sui generis, but she would have gotten a lot of similar attacks. And we know that because Nancy Pelosi has been getting them over the past few years. Kamala Harris.
Elizabeth Warren.
Exactly.
Kamala Harris. Yeah.
They are coming.
Everybody.
And they are coming for women.
Yep. Okay, if I had to pick, I also, especially after 2016, have a little bit of PTSD when it comes to making predictions. So let me say this. It will be determined, I think, by who the Democrats put forward as their nominee. I think, and I don't know if this is a popular opinion or not, but I think the Democrats, by Hillary Clinton being the nominee, I think she was one of the only people who could have lost. She was such a polarizing figure, with decades of hatred, deep, deep hatred against her. But the other side too, is I think we all underestimated, you know, kind of racism and people willing to vote on those lines. So I don't know. I think it's going to depend on who the Democrats put forward, what kind of a person and what type of candidate that person is. They need someone who is obviously charismatic and a good communicator and all of those things, but who can lay out a really clear and compelling alternative that a big tent of people will want to vote for. So that was a weasel out of that question without actually putting a name to it. But I do think a lot is hinging on the Democratic primary. So we'll see what happens. Okay. Next question. Who is a religious figure from a different faith that you admire or look up to?
I'll say Rabbi Jill Jacobs is one. There are so many religious leaders that I look up to and admire their work. But her work on human rights really is just inspiring and is an example of what I try to teach our kids out of Judaism, the idea of tikkun olam and the responsibility to make the earth a better place, whether it's literally environmentalism or, in these cases, making people better so that they will make other people's lives better.
Okay. I had the great benefit of, like I mentioned earlier, living in Salt Lake City, so being in really close proximity to the LDS faith. And I had the great fortune of meeting two men who sit in what's called the Quorum of the 12 Apostles in the church, which is the second highest governing body underneath like the first presidency, like the, so the very, very tip top. But this body really does kind of oversee the majority of the work of the church. And there are two guys that are on that council or who are on that quorum. Number one is Elder Jeffrey R. Holland, and the other one is Elder Dieter F. Uchtdorf. And both of those guys, if you listen to any of their talks, any of their addresses that they've given, the thing that I love about them is that they are, I really see them wanting their faith and wanting the expression of the Mormon faith to be inclusive and to be welcoming and to be hospitable to everyone. And that includes people with mental illness, which Jeffrey R. Holland has talked about at length. He gave a really lovely, lovely talk that was really kind of groundbreaking in the LDS church about caring for people with mental illness, or if you are a person with mental illness, of like, it's nothing to be ashamed of. It's nothing that you need to hide. It's not sin. It's not because you haven't prayed enough. It's not any of those things, which was revolutionary for LDS folks to hear. And also Elder Uchtdorf, who just constantly talks about just the welcoming nature of who Jesus is and who he calls us to be. I have found him to be just a wonderful, lovely individual. And I had the great opportunity of meeting and spending time with both of those guys. And they're both just, they are exactly who you expect them to be when you meet them. They are warm. They are inclusive. They are kind and generous with their time and their attention. And yeah, I don't know. They're just great, great, great dudes. So those are probably my two. Okay. Oh gosh. We're almost done. Okay. Next one. What's your favorite TV show of all time? That it feels like I have to choose between my children.
This is so hard, listeners. Yeah, I can't choose. So I'm going to say Justified and Veronica Mars.
Oh, both great shows. Veronica Mars. Dang.
First season of Veronica Mars, just so almost good. Perfect. And Justified, I could watch. I shouldn't say I could watch the pilot hundreds of times. I have watched it dozens of times.
That's awesome.
And those are probably the two shows where I miss the characters now that they're gone. I just want to like hear the way that they talk again.
Yep.
Which is why I keep rewatching them.
Yep.
What about you?
Okay. My first one has to be Big Love, which was on HBO, about a modern Mormon polygamist family with the late Bill Paxton and Chloe Sevigny, and it's just great cast. Jennifer Goodwin. Such a great show. Such a great show. Okay, that's one. Friday Night Lights. Yes, the football show. I actually watched this show on Netflix after it had already ended, and I want to retroactively go back in time and give them all of the Emmys. It was one of the best shows, like one of the best written shows, character development, acting. It was just so good. It was so good. It was so good. And I think the main actor who played Coach Taylor, Kyle Channing. Is that right? Chandler.
There you go.
I had to think on the spot. He won the Emmy for Best Actor the very final season. So I was really happy about that. So Friday Night Lights, Oldie But Goodie is Alias. With Jennifer Garner.
Alias. Yeah.
God, it was so good.
It just
Jennifer
went
Garner.
Crazy pants, but yes, I loved it.
Yeah, it did go super sci-fi, but you know what? I couldn't quit it, and I still won't. I will still defend it to the day I die. I loved seeing this like badass female super spy as a lead. And Jennifer Garner was just exceptional. Michael Vartan was exceptional. Victor Garber, everyone was so good. So anyway, great show. And actually Bradley Cooper, before he was like ginormous, huge movie star.
I know.
Was on Alias.
He was the like sidekick who had a crush on Jennifer Garner and she wouldn't pay attention to him.
He was in the friend zone, perpetual friend zone. Poor Bradley. We were so sad about that. Okay. And last but not least, of course, Game of Thrones.
Not till 2019.
Patiently.
They're torturing us.
Impatiently waiting for the very last season. I know. It's dark time for me in TV. But it'll come back. Anyway. Okay. Those are mine. Next question. Dogs or cats? I'm a dog person.
I'm a cat person. Done.
I'm a dog person because I'm allergic to cats. So, and my husband is allergic to cats. I do like cats. I just can't be around them. So there you go. Okay. If you could, this is a hard one.
This is a hard one.
This is our last question.
With.
Yeah. Okay. Golly. If you could reverse one policy that Trump has enacted, what would you pick?
You know what I would pick? And not just because it's the most recent, but because of all the horrible, horrible, horrible things that have been going on over the last year and a half.
Yep.
It is the image, even in my head, of families being separated that just tears me apart.
Yeah.
I cannot handle that.
Yeah.
And I know our country throughout its history has been tearing families apart. This is not new, but it is kind of new in this way. Families coming here looking for asylum, not trying to like sneak in, just walking right up to representatives of our government saying, we seek refuge. And being divided because these nitwits in the White House think that that's going to be a deterrent to people who are fleeing for fear of their lives. I simply don't have the words.
That was mine as well. I mean, there are a lot of things that you can talk about. You can talk about taxes. You can talk about healthcare. You can talk about the ban on refugees. You can talk, I mean, there's a thousand different ones, but this one, the intentional act of separating young children from their mothers and then placing those children alone in like a foster care system, it's just so cruel. It's dark. Like, it's just a dark, horrible, like horrific thing to do. I cannot imagine being a mom who was wanting to go to a new place to like make a better life for my child who I'm carrying with me, only to have that child forcibly taken from my arms and with no promise of ever seeing them again. I get so raging mad thinking about it. I almost start shaking because it keeps me from crying. It's just the most horrific thing that I can imagine as a parent. And that our president decided that that was a policy worth putting in place to act as a deterrent, that he would find a need to resort to that kind of cruelty is absolutely terrible. And yeah. Anyway, that would definitely be mine. It is the most recent, and it is in the news a lot right now. So yeah, that would definitely be mine. But hopefully, you know, we'll see that changed as the outcry grows louder. And there's a lot of people doing a lot of fundraising work, trying to get legal help for some of these families that have been separated. So keep your eyes out for that. We'll post links in the show notes to some of those opportunities that you can contribute to help, because we're not helpless in this sort of situation. So we will try to find a way and different avenues for you to contribute or help if that is your desire. Okay.
And for now, we will wrap up the show with our praise and petition segment, in which we shout out the things that are bringing us joy and call out the people and situations who are making us cranky. Nish, do you want to go first?
Sure. Thing that's making me cranky, aside from President Trump being a monster and separating children from their families, is none other than another enemy of the pod, nemesis of the pod, Franklin Graham, going to California on, like, I don't know what you want to call it, like a crusade, I guess, to like take back California from its evil liberalism, and saying, I think he equated being progressive. I think he said progressive. That's just another word for godless. Screw you, dude. That's what I have to say. So that is making me cranky this week. But something that is wonderful and that is bringing me a lot of joy, and that's just been awesome to watch, has been our street. We have moved on to an idyllic, wonderful, incredible, magical street that all of, there's like, I think including all of the second home folks. So we live in a vacation town, and there's some houses on our street that are actually second homes, vacation homes to folks. And including the second home folks, there's 12 kids that are second grade and under. And so, and all of the kids have become friends with each other. And yesterday on Memorial Day, they were all out playing baseball in the street, and we were eating homemade strawberry ice cream. I mean, it was out of some weird, like, cliche Americana scene. It really felt like I was just sitting in the scene of a movie. It was just really, really lovely and wonderful. And all the kids are so great, and all the parents are wonderful, and we all get along, and we all share really similar values and hopes for our kids. And it's just this really fun place to be. So that this weekend particularly was just fantastic. We had like perfect weather. It was 72 degrees all weekend. And so it was just idyllic. And that brought me so much joy. I almost haven't wanted to talk about it because I'm like, I kind of want to put it in my back pocket. It's just this thing just for me to like remember and hold on to. But it was too wonderful. I have to share it. So
that's great.
Great weekend. We moved on to a great street. What about you? What's going on in your world?
Well, I need to call out the Southern Baptist Convention, which as of this recording is still planning to have Paige Patterson give an address to its annual meeting in just a few weeks. This after he was forced to resign. And yeah, I think it's pretty clear what they think of women by apparently having to debate whether this is a good idea. At least I assume that's what's going on. Maybe not even that much. So calling you out for that, SBC. And in terms of things that are bringing me joy, other than the fact that summer is here and we are back at the beach, which is just a lovely thing. I have mentioned before the podcast, The Irish Passport, which I continue to love, but particularly in the past week with the Irish vote on the referendum to change the Constitution when it came to abortion. It has been so interesting to have it as a resource. They recorded an episode right after the votes came out, and it had looked leading up to the vote like it was going to be very, very close. And the yes to change the Constitution vote ended up winning by 66%, which nobody saw coming. And I think this can be an interesting result, whether you think of yourself as pro-life or pro-choice, because what the proposal is still extremely restrictive. I don't believe currently that any U.S. state is quite this restrictive, but the proposal is to replace the constitutional ban on abortion with a law that would allow it up to 12 weeks. And that is, that's basically first trimester. Most states right now are debating a 20-week ban. What is really interesting to me that I've learned from listening to the podcast is the way that the government went about this. They had a panel of ordinary citizens, kind of the way you would pull together a grand jury, who heard evidence and testimony on the issue. And I have to look into more details on this in terms of exactly how long this went on. But the result was that it served kind of as like a national both education process, but also airing of concerns and beliefs, and ended up being kind of cathartic for the country. And that's obviously not something that we do. I don't even know if it would be doable in a country the size of the United States, whereas Ireland is a few million people. But it's so fascinating because there are ethical quandaries that are coming at us really fast and are just going to increase in number as technology progresses. And there are many times when I wish we could just all sit down and have a national conversation about some of this stuff and figure out what we think about it. And in Ireland, they actually did. And then they moved to a vote. And anyway, it's just been historic over there, and really interesting in terms of a case study in how a country grapples with something that's been really painful for a lot of the women there. Again, whether they wanted to avail themselves of abortion services or not, a lot of Irish women just felt like their health needs and needs just as people and individuals were not of the concern of the government. And so that is something that's been bringing me joy, has been following the coverage of that.
That's actually a great one. It was, for me, no matter how you feel about abortion or, you know, whatever, it was just encouraging to see like so many women like fly home. The hashtag home to vote, isn't that what it was? Home to vote. To see so many women like book flights and trains and just to vote on this issue was really, really awesome to see that level of civic engagement and for this to matter. So like something like this to matter so much that they would make those, you know, efforts to come home and vote was awesome to watch. So I totally agree. It was a good story. Okay. Well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support our show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids!